Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, I'm speaking with Jillian O'Brien, the owner and president of the Pediatric Development Center in Westbrook, Maine, for a conversation about working with patients with selective eating. Welcome, Jillian. Can you tell us a bit about your work at the Pediatric Development Center?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So I have been the owner of the Pediatric Development Center for about 10 years now, and we provide occupational therapy services to children, wide range of ages and diagnoses. We focus on holistically looking at the child. And so we might be working on developmental skills. We might be working on feeding and eating, as we're talking about today, or we might be working on self-regulation. Really, you name it. If it's impacting the child developmentally, we're going to try to figure out how to help them with it.
And how about age range?
Really, for the most part, we will do any age range, birth through adult even. We do have some adult clients who come here. Often we will refer for the young little itty bitty infants to be in the home, but we do have times where clients who will choose to bring their child here who is at the infant stage.
That's great. Well, let's talk about how children develop selective eating tendencies and just some do's and don'ts for people working to make changes with them.
Yeah, certainly. I think that, first of all, parents are often told that it is a behavior and or control issue with the child. And while this is definitely can be a contributing factor, and children, you know, with children, there's a lot of things that they cannot control. And eating and feeding is one of the few things that they can have some control over in their life. And so I think that this can be a variable, but it's not the only variable most of the time. Often we also need to be looking at if there are inefficient or delayed oral motor skills. Eating really is a very complex oral motor process, and there can be delays within that development, which can really cause a child to restrict and limit the foods that they're comfortable eating. When we look at from a developmental hierarchy perspective, there are really about 27 steps that we look at to get full oral motor skill development for more complex foods, you know, starting with just licking the lips to taste the food, to holding food in, putting it in the mouth, to moving food around in the mouth, to munching with an up and down jaw pattern, to emerging rotary chewing, to use of tongue lateralization, and then to really a full rotary chewing where you create that bolus of food and then you're able to swallow it all. I think another variable to think about are the sensory challenges that come along with food. You have children who have tactile sensitivity, and there are certain foods that really don't feel right in their mouth. It can make them gag, it can make them very uncomfortable, and then they will set up some negative associations with foods as well. I think it's important to also think about that you have children that might have either trauma or injury or pain that's associated with feeding. So they will then have those negative experiences, and feeding is not a pleasurable experience for them. And I think also you really need to think about developmental stages. Kids go through different developmental stages. Take, for example, around, you know, 3 to 5 or 6 children in that age of irrational fears, and they will start to associate, you know, one thing with another, which they'll connect these different events. Let's say, for example, that they ate like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and then right after that, they fell and hurt themselves. And so then all of a sudden they decide peanut butter and jelly sandwiches aren't safe to eat anymore because they got hurt on the same day that they ate that sandwich. So I think those are some of the reasons why we start to see some of those tendencies with that selective and picky eating come out. And I think really typically it's a combination of multiple. It's not just one of them, and really looking at, you know, sort of what that organic problem is, and then how did that maybe create that behavior to then spiral into more challenges.
That's great. That was just so much information. I'm just thinking about your approach and how it might change
depending on the age of the patient. I mean, if a patient or a client, I'm not sure if you call them patients or clients, but if you have someone who comes in and they used to eat lots of different types of foods, and then as they became closer to, you know, 7 or 8 years old, then they started getting more selective. Does your approach change compared to someone who maybe has always been very selective with what they're willing to eat?
Yeah, absolutely. We try to get a full history to look a little bit more specifically at that and try to find out, was there some sort of event that might have caused the decrease in it? So sometimes there was a choking event or a gagging event, or there was a sickness, there was a vomiting episode. And so then we see that it decreased at that point in time. But we also want to look to see if we notice that those oral motor skills are delayed, even if it's a child who's say 7 or 8 and their parents are saying they ate more foods and now they're not. We want to look at, well, did you start introducing more foods? Did you start making the bite sizes bigger? Were they suddenly not able to manage foods that you thought that they once could, but now the expectation you made higher? And so then they started taking more and more foods out that they did previously eat. We also think it's important to look developmentally that at a younger age, we're going to use more of a very playful, play-based approach. And then as we get older, we turn it into more of a food scientist approach. So really catering that to the different ages to really hit them at the right developmental level.
Well, one of the things I've done in the past with some of my patients is participated in a program with them called Cooking Matters. And I'm not sure if that's something you're familiar with, but it's really helping people learn how to cook healthy food on a budget. And really one of the reasons I started doing it with my patients was because of this challenge of having some individuals who were really narrow with what they'd be willing to eat. And, you know, the understanding that sometimes when kids are participating in the cooking process, they may feel more willing to try things. And, you know, I've uncovered some incredible experiences. I had an adolescent who had never tried a strawberry since like really early in childhood. And we had strawberries in one of the classes and he tried them and he liked them. And I always wonder, you know, maybe when he tried strawberries back when he was an infant or, you know, a young child, he just happened to have one that wasn't a good one. And then, like you said, you know, in the child brain, like, well, this is what all strawberries taste like. And so I'm not going to like it. You know, I was sort of on that vein. What types of advice are you giving parents to try with their kids at home that might involve cooking or play with food, like you were talking about, if kids are younger?
Yeah, I think that what you just said really hits the nail on the head for what we recommend all the time is that as a parent, sometimes you need to step back from the expectation being eat this food. And that if you can remove that expectation and let there be more exploration with food, a lot of times that's when the magic will happen. Because a lot of children are coming to the table with the expectation of it's time to eat. And if they are worried and they're anxious, then, you know, with anxiety, there's an adrenaline spike. And your adrenaline spike causes a decrease in your appetite. It's an appetite suppressant. And so if you have this appetite suppressant coming, so every mealtime, maybe they're less hungry, then you've just set up this challenging mealtime. If you go and you're just cooking with the foods and the expectation isn't as much, oh, you need to eat this food, but we're just more exploring with it, you've kind of put them in a place where they're not as anxious and they might feel more comfortable and might feel more safe. I think you also need to think about that the more that you explore with foods, that you're getting more comfortable with it. So as opposed to it just being on a plate and with the expectation for you to eat, when you're cooking with it, you're touching it, you're getting that tactile exploration, you might be getting the scent of it, you might be getting the smell of it. And we really encourage interactions with food without having the expectation of eating it.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I wasn't sure if I should ask that. It was one of my questions I was thinking about asking, but you mentioned that anxiety isn't always the issue sort of when we first started talking. But I do feel like with the kids I'm seeing in clinic, you know, it often can be that this is a kid who's got anxiety and has really dug in around what types of foods that they're willing to try. And it does feel sometimes like there is definitely that connection for some people.
I would absolutely agree. And I think a lot of times, like I said, it's, you know, it's multifaceted. So you've got that element of it, but then you've got something else. So if you have a child who maybe has some developmental skills that are challenging their eating. And so now they're more nervous going to the table. And so now you've got increased anxiety with going to the table. And so it can be multiple pieces of that. And so we really talk about using calming and regulating strategies for children before they get to the table and creating routines so that they know more what to expect and kind of having it be more consistent. Because as we know, the more you can provide that consistency, then the more they know the expectations and what's going to happen, and they can feel a little bit more calm and regulated.
This is great. So, you know, when does it make sense for a pediatrician or family doc, a provider for a child's health, to consider making referral to a program like yours for a kid who's got selective eating?
Yeah, that I think that's a great question. And I find we have families that come in who are often in tears, and they say, "Oh, I've been saying that my child doesn't eat much, and I just kept being told like they'll eventually eat, and they haven't been." So I think it's really great to talk about when would be the right time to refer. I think some things to really consider is if you're having negative mealtimes, are there constant battles when you go to, you know, whether it be breakfast, lunch, dinner, or all of them? You know, for some children, it's all of them. And if you put that into perspective, you have, you know, 21 meals over the course of a week, right? Between breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 7 days a week. And if each one of those is a battle, you're having 21 battles already set up in your week. And that's too much. That's too much. Mealtime should be an enjoyable experience. And if that's not happening, I think that's really important to be considering. I think also if families are short order cooking, and so you're always having a separate meal that the children are having and the families are having a different meal, that's a pretty clear indicator that there should be some more intervention, or at least having it be looked at a little bit more. I think you should also consider how it's impacting their peer relations and family outings. Are they able to go to a friend's house and be able to eat food there? Or is it really impacting them to the point where you're needing to alter their peer interactions and your family outings? And I think you also need to look at the level to which a child maybe is falling apart when new foods are introduced. Is it a child who is running and screaming from the table if a new food is even put on the plate or on the table? And are there big giant reactions to new foods even being introduced? I think that that's definitely a red flag to be considering. And then finally, I do think you look at the variety of foods. You know, is it a child or the family saying they eat five foods and only five foods? And that is definitely significant. You want a child to be, you know, eating a variety of foods. We look at it in three different areas. We look at it as food is food. You've got your proteins, you've got your starches and carbohydrates, and you've got your fruits and vegetables. Foods fall into one of those three categories. And we want to make sure that there's enough food in each of those categories that a child can go 2 days without eating the same food. And if you don't have enough food in those categories to go breakfast, lunch, and dinner without eating that same food, then it's really something to be considering getting a little bit more assistance with.
That's a great way to look at it. I do see a number of people who that's, you know, sort of a challenge for us. So I probably should be referring more patients, more of my patients to you. So what kind of expectations should, as a referring provider, should our families hear when we say, okay, we're going to make this referral? Like, I can imagine, since you're seeing people with a really wide range of sort of a function or dysfunction, however you want to look at it, that some people you may have a shorter number of visits with and others you may be seeing for a longer period of time. What's the range like?
Yeah, that is the $1 million question. You know, we start with the evaluation and we look to see, you know, of the different, you know, domain areas, what is it that's impacting them? You know, is it the oral motor skills? Is it the sensory? Is it the behavior? Is it a combination of all of that? And then we do our sessions, you know, in the clinic with the child, but what's really important is to have the carryover at home. And so sometimes it's really a matter of how much carryover at home is the family able to do. And we found that families that are really able to carry over and really implement the strategies and suggestions, we can have much faster progress. And so it's not going to be a fast turnaround in the sense of they're not going to come for two or three sessions and boom, they're eating everything. It is a slow progression because we do work at finding the child's level and then slowly getting them as comfortable as possible to move up it's our steps to eating hierarchy is what we use. And so by using that, we follow their lead and get them to go higher and higher up that hierarchy till they finally get to the point of eating certain foods. So it's very hard to say how long one particular child will be here. I can say that we tend to have faster success the younger they are. The more playful it can be, the more plasticity that we're able to work with neurologically, it tends to be a faster progression with the younger kids. And the longer it's gone on, and the child might get to the point where they don't care as much. They're not as bought in, and they're happy to be eating just what they're eating. Those kids, it can take a lot longer with.
Well, you started talking a little bit about the approach you use, and I wanted to ask some questions. So I know you're using the sequential oral sensory approach to feeding.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could tell us a bit about the approach and about maybe when it is effective or maybe when it's less effective. And I looked up a little bit about this, and I know that there's not necessarily strong evidence that it's effective in a setting of like autism, for example, or but it's not like there's a lot of studies saying it isn't, more so much that there just aren't a lot of studies. Can you give us more information about, you know, are there certain conditions where it works better than others, or and just your perspective?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the training that we have here is that sequential oral sensory, otherwise known as SOS, which ironically fits into the life of a lot of families' feelings at mealtimes. And it really is looking at developmentally, looking at that hierarchy of skills. So that's sort of part of the sequential, or part of the sequential and the oral, is where are they at from a developmental perspective? And then it's also looking at then, like I said, meeting them at their level and then going up that hierarchy. So starting at a level of tolerate, how do they tolerate the food being either in the room, on the table, et cetera. Moving to an interact with level, are they able to interact with it with a utensil? Are they able to interact with it with a spoon? Are they able to then smell it? Are they able to then go up to a touch level? And from a touch level, it looks at not just touching with their fingers, but are they able to touch the food to various aspects perhaps of their face? So it moves up their body from further away at your hands to maybe getting closer to your mouth from a touch level. And then that next hierarchy would be the taste level. And then the next hierarchy goes up to the eat. So we use these steps to figure out where is the child comfortable so that we can systematically build that. And it uses a very playful approach to having the child get comfortable by, again, the expectation not being that this new food is in front of you to eat, but we're going to explore with the food. And it's really fascinating to watch. We do this during our evaluations with parents where we have them bring in some preferred and some non-preferred foods, and they'll bring in the non-preferred foods where they say, they never eat this, forget about it, it's not going to happen. And we do our fun, playful approach, and we show them different strategies that we use. And the next thing they know, the child licks the food, kisses the food, bites the food, eats the food, and they stare at me and their mouth is dropped going, how did that just happen? And so it's a nice segue to then explain how this approach can be really successful with kids. As you said, with some kids, it might not be as successful, or we might need to sort of just adapt it a little bit. And that certainly can be the case, again, sometimes for the older children, and also maybe sometimes for some of those diagnoses. And that then is really trying to figure out how we want to adapt it. With the older kids, we use more of that food science approach versus a playful approach. So we're looking scientifically at foods. We really talk a lot about the properties of foods and what makes one food different than another food, and how can we link it to a preferred food, and how are things the same and different. In terms of some of those other diagnoses, maybe say an autism diagnosis, we have had some success and we have had some challenges with children who are on the autism spectrum, and really trying to use what works well with them and from a consistency standpoint can be really useful. And so adapting it in a way that we create the session to be modeled in the same way each time, and then we're slowly changing what we're doing with different foods. But we also can work on those oral motor skills regardless. So we're always trying to figure out how can we make those oral motor skills stronger so that then they are safer to eat different foods, but they also feel more comfortable eating different foods.
And one of the things I've noticed, and I'm wondering if you must see probably more than I did, or maybe not, because the parents aren't eating in your interactions probably, but when I've done the cooking classes, it's a family thing. So we have a parent and a child. And a number of times when a child that I enrolled in the course, the parents, one of the concerns was they were a selective eater. When we actually get into the cooking class, we realize one of the parents who's coming is also a selective eater. It just didn't happen to come out beforehand. And it's interesting, I some of the sort of learned behaviors, or maybe, you know, kids like to connect with their parents. Do you see that firsthand too? Is that something you're noticing?
Absolutely. I think that looking at the family dynamics is very important, because when you have a parent who maybe is talking about food in such a way that a child is then internalizing, oh, well, this is a gross food, or, you know, they've heard their parents say certain things, then they certainly can take that on. And I think, you know, one of the things that we really talk about is to make sure when we're talking about food that we're not using those kinds of adjectives, that we're talking about the properties of the food, and we're not talking about that we like it or we don't like it, or it's bad or it's gross, but we're talking about that it's crunchy, or it's wet, or it has a strong smell or a big flavor, and really talking about those properties so that we can change maybe some of those dynamics of what's happening.
I'm glad you just said that, because another segue to something else I've noticed in clinic I would love your opinion on is that I have a number of patients who, it's so common that I almost laugh every time a family says it. I'm like, get in another one. They like fruit, like they'll like apples, they'll like pears, they'll eat berries, but they won't eat any vegetables. And then you kind of push, like, so none at all. Well, then they'll eat some raw vegetables, carrots, raw sweet peppers, cucumbers. And you think it's the texture. It must be the texture. And is this stuff that you're seeing too?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important to think about when you talk about maybe a raw vegetable versus a cooked vegetable is, for one, when you cook a vegetable, you change the properties of it. So it now not only smells different, it tastes different, and it also feels different in the mouth. That being said, it's if you don't cook it exactly the same way every time, it's a different food every time as well. Versus if you take something that is in the raw form, it's going to be more consistent each time that a child has it. And so therefore, keeping it consistent, there's a level of, I know this food, I understand how it's going to break down in my mouth, I understand what it's going to taste like. And when you change that variable, it can seem very different. And I think that can be really hard. I think, you know, you said fruits and vegetables, but I feel like we often also find that there is a long list in the starch and carbohydrate section, and there is a shorter list in the fruit and vegetable section. And if you think about what I just said there, starches and carbohydrates, you take your Ritz cracker is going to be a Ritz cracker, and it's going to be the same every time that you eat that food. You take a blueberry, and that blueberry might be tart, it might be sweet, it might be squishier, it might be a little bit more firm. It's not necessarily the same food every time you eat it. So there's different variables to consider when you're even just thinking about the food. And I always encourage parents to spend some time and take a bite of different foods. And as you're eating that food, analyze it. What's going on in your mouth? What changes? How does it feel? How does it taste? With foods that when you're eating them, you now have liquid that comes out of them. You now are managing the liquid of a food with chewing food at the same time. And so now it's a multi-textural thing. And so really kind of breaking it down and understanding how these different foods are in the mouth, I think can really be a powerful tool for parents to understand a little bit more.
So, yeah, I think that's great. I hadn't really thought about that, sort of the consistency of a lot of the starches are, you know, they're the same almost every time. And that's absolutely true. I see a lot of that, you know, when people will come in and have a limited limited variety of what they're eating. Oftentimes it is, they'll eat a lot of carbs and not, sometimes no meat, sometimes no fruits or vegetables are very limited. And that hadn't thought about it that way. Really, it's the, you know, just that consistency and predictability that of those that maybe it makes it a little bit more safe or feel a little bit more safe to someone who can be more selective.
I think another fun strategy though to think about too is to, again, get back to the exploration. So take different kitchen gadgets and kitchen tools. You talked about cooking, but I also think there's so many great tools and gadgets out there. You know, you've got your your egg slicer or your little mini choppers or your garlic presses or whatever you want to find, and then use those with different foods. Let the child have fun with it and explore. And then if that makes them get more comfortable and they're able to then, you know, touch it or taste it or put it in their mouth, like let them just explore with it and kind of keep that thought in the back of your head that it doesn't have to go to just that consumption piece.
I think that's great. And, you know, one of the things I know we had talked about a little bit ahead of time that isn't necessarily your approach or your basis, but actually seems very compatible with a lot of the things that you're sharing today is Ellen Satter's approach. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a registered dietitian and family therapist and pediatricians. She's probably for selective eaters, the resource that people think of. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. the name that comes to mind that she has an institute. And really a lot of the stuff, you know, she kind of divides things into different responsibilities. Like, okay, the parent's responsibility is really related to the feeding and the child's is really related more to the actual eating. And, you know, a caregiver has to choose and prepare a food, provide the food, you know, trying to set the stage for making mealtime pleasant and really modeling, you know, what the eating experience should be like. And over time, the expectation that your child is going to be eating the foods that you're eating, where the child really is supposed to be deciding how much of the food that they eat and how to behave, you know, when, you know, modeling after how their parents are, what they're showing them. And really, I have tended to like a lot of the advice, but I do get a little concerned in the setting of kids who carry extra weight. We know their hormones are off with regard to stimulation for hunger. They may have excessive hunger. Mm-hmm. And in their current food environment with some really calorie dense selections and maybe families that don't even always have access to a lot of the healthiest foods, how maybe advice that worked in a different food environment, in our current food environment, it may not work as well. I don't know if you, mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's not your thing, but if you have thoughts about sort of the food environment and how we're exposing kids to different types of foods. Do you try to focus more when the kids come in on the foods that are particularly healthy, or is really trying variety in any way feel like an advantage to, you know, moving them forward?
I think a lot of times when the children who are coming into us that are, you know, super selective, have very, very limited foods, for us, it's really about increasing that variety. And like I said, we look at it from trying to get it into those three different categories of the protein, fruit and vegetable, and starch and carbohydrate. And I think that, you know, I am somewhat familiar with that division of responsibility yeah. that she has. And I do think that there are some great aspects to that. I think it's, you know, as any of these are, it's one tool to have in your tool belt to try to think about what can work and what might help. I think, you know, when you talk again about some of these kids who crave certain foods, there's a lot of research out there too, as well, that talks about how some of these kids have really, really difficult, you know, gut problems, and intestinally their body might not even be breaking it down the same, and that they can crave things that their body is actually not, happy with. And so that can make it challenging too, because if you're saying, you know, have this positive relationship with this food so that it's, they eat it when they want to eat it, I think there are times that might make it a little bit more challenging with certain populations.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so wonderful that we have resources like yours to be able to send our families to. And I really love how you focus on trying to make, you know, mealtime a pleasant thing. I can imagine when having a child who only eats three or four things, I'm sure you're panicked about their health, and really being able to kind of, you know, step back and say, okay, let's have a practical way to approach this with some support, which just, it's excellent. So for referrals, do typically multiple insurances cover for selective eating, or is coverage an issue, cost of care an issue at all?
You know, that is a great question that you just brought up, because very exciting in the world of feeding right now is on October 1st, which is tomorrow, there is a new ICD-10 pediatric feeding disorder code that is going to be added, which is so very exciting. And so that's going to be a new one. Hopefully insurance companies can get on that and have that be, you know, in their system, because it's going to be really appropriate to so many of these children. That being said, we generally find that services are covered as long as, you know, the insurance deductibles are met, et cetera, you know, all those various insurance pieces. But we are our clinic is billing it from an occupational therapy standpoint. So as long as there is that coverage for that service, then it is covered. But we do need to show that a child is making progress with their goals. And so again, the more that is happening at home and the progress is happening, then the more that we're able to continue to get that reimbursement and justification for services.
Well, I think this is probably all we have time for today, but we probably should have another conversation because there's so much more we could talk about. So thank you so much for joining us. And I know our local folks will probably want to start using more of your resources because I know we're all seeing this in clinic.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. Please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go, with technical support from Maine Health Educational Services. Thanks so much for joining us.